Within each ministry, what you will find is people who are champions of change.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. At the end of May, the 2024 Education World Forum took place in London. It's the world's largest gathering of education and skills ministers. Tahir Andrabi of the School of Education at Lahore University of Management Sciences, also of Panoma College, was in attendance in his capacity as a member of the Global Education Evidence Advisory Panel. He joins me today to talk about his experience at the forum this year and how Geep's research can get traction with the policymakers who were there. Tahir, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you very much.
Last year, 2023, we spoke to Rachel Glenister about the GEEP report that year, looking at the cost-effective approaches to improve global learning. Remind us, though, about GEEP's mission and its working method.
Okay, I think that it's good to start with this contradiction. Global research on education in low and middle income countries has increased quite dramatically in the last decade, and more work is being done, mostly on applied work, on thinking about causal effects of interventions. So a lot of research is coming on. And in fact, in one of my conversations with these ministers, the term he used was a bewildering array. And so the question, of course, is not all research is of the same quality. Not all research is spread all over the place. And so one of the ideas behind GEEP was to curate research so that we can really think about what is rigorous research, what is research which we think we can vouch for. And then secondly, to really bundle it in some ways that it is actually useful for people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in that sense, the idea of GEEP was to create some recommendations around research that have been rigorously curated and as exhaustive as we can. In our work as independent researchers and scholars of public policy, this was something that we thought was really needed. It was coming up in conversations with policymakers. So that was really the motivation.
Is it enough to produce the report, or do you have to go out and advocate for it to make sure that it gets read?
No, that's a very good point. If you build it, they will not necessarily come, I think.
Yeah.
The report itself, first of all, the content of the report and how we highlighted it, I think that does get people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, this idea of both effectiveness and cost effectiveness. In most of the world, people don't really think about effectiveness in terms of outcomes. A lot of effectiveness in terms of, we did a following program, we did this, and financial audits, the program worked. When they say program worked, they really meant the program was implemented. What its results were, what its outcomes were, I think that focus in our report by itself does fix people's attention in a way which we want. Then the second thing, of course, is the cost idea. While most of our conversations are with the education ministries, we all know that the finance ministries really make very big decisions in terms of not just education budgets, but also in terms of approvals of various programs and so on. And so the cost part, I think that's something that we are very mm-hmm. particular about. There are some interventions which are way more costly than others. There are others which are an order of magnitude cheaper. So, you know, you could have pedagogical interventions, which are not that difficult to implement, or learning methodology. On the other hand, infrastructure, hardware, things of that sort are very expensive to put in. So I think that how do you really bring all of those in is a conversation which the policymakers, at least in some level, are quite interested in. Having said that, I found in my own work as a member of the GEEP panel, I presented the GEEP report and recommendations in a few countries. So country visits, talking to people, talking to universities, talking to media, all of those are needed. I think it's the beginning of a conversation. I think that we have to push it and we want to make sure that there is a robust dialogue going.
There's a lot of people involved in the production of this report. How is it that you end up with this advocacy role? Did you volunteer for it?
There is the panel, which is the scientific advisory panel, a group of independent academics. I got involved in it because I was asked by the people who were organizing it whether I wanted to be on it. I think the quality of the people on the panel and the interdisciplinary nature. There are some really top-notch economists. There are top-notch people from psychology, from education, from, let's call it, the real world. I think it's a way to make an imprint on bringing this kind of evidence-based view into the forefront, not just the advocacy part, but also the curating part. I think all of us on the panel, at least the researchers, have been actively involved, myself included, in creating some of these studies that have been used in the GEEB report. So I think this opportunity at having a platform to bring this view that we take evidence seriously and we want to bring this methodology into policy, I think that was the real motivation to be able to make a potential impact there.
So take us back to this forum, the Education World Forum 2024. What is the purpose of the Education World Forum?
The Education World Forum is really a meeting place. It's a huge event with over 100 countries and their ministerial delegations involved. And typically, it has a unifying theme. I think that there is a lot of knowledge sharing. There is a lot of sense of what other countries are doing and their approaches. And so the key part was that we had meetings with about 6 or 7 ministerial delegations, having a dialogue on some of their reform agendas. So that was very nice to see what their priorities are, how they are thinking about it, and then also trying to assess their capabilities in terms of implementing that reform agenda, and then talking about some of the stuff that the GEEB report was talking about. So I think that was quite useful. To give you an example, for instance, having a conversation on early childhood development programs, one of my GEEB fellow panelists is Sally Grantham McGregor, who's really a world expert on this. So one of the interesting conversations was in thinking about education in early childhood, but how to really combine this with the already existing infrastructure on early childhood that the ministries of health have done. That was an insight that we could really have a conversation with education people. That both makes it effective and perhaps even more cost effective.
But when you're having these meetings, are you finding that you are meeting people at the right level, decision makers, people that can really change the direction of policy within their country?
Yes, I think that's very important. Policy change is not a simple phenomenon.
No.
It requires workings and meetings of lots of different stakeholders, sure. However, I think it's really important to talk to people who are at the helm of things. I think that's really important. And it's also very interesting that we were meeting both the political class, which is the ministers, many of them were the elected ministers, but then also their technical staff, so some of the technical education people and their advisors, and also the civil servants. So I think the three of them together, I think, is a very interesting group to talk to. All three of them bring their own perspectives. And it's also interesting to see the relationships among the three in different delegations.
I can imagine. So tell me, when you're in the room with them, what do you want to put across to them? And what do they want to know from you?
What you want to get across to them is the idea of bringing evidence into decision-making and following this process of implementation, which is kind of used in health from efficacy to effectiveness to scaling up. So that process, we're really trying to see whether they go through that, because lots of people have good ideas.
Yeah.
And I think lots of ideas in education, all of us have gone through the education system. All of us have know in our own minds what worked in our own background. So education is not like some arcane science where, you know, nobody knows how molecules work and all that. Everybody has some idea about what they think is needed in education. But then it's important to think about going beyond their own personal experiences and backgrounds to thinking about broader data and experience. And I am personally very interested in the data capabilities of governments. How much do we know about our children? How much do we know about variation in learning in our children? How much do we know about the learning of children who are at the bottom end of the income distribution? So I'm interested in seeing how much in granular detail do these governments pay attention within their own system. To give you an example, one of the themes of the World Education Forum was AI and technology, really trying to understand their views on technology and data.
And do you find that they are getting better at collecting the information that they could act on?
I think it's fair to say that it's an ongoing process.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things that we talked about, which some of the GEEB panel members have a lot of experience in, is this idea of embedding labs within the government. So there are a bunch of researchers who are experimenting with that. which is that how do you create capability within government for data analysis, but also in terms of evaluating what they are doing. I think that's a big part of it. So I think it's happening, but you have to remember many of these countries are really large, complex systems. I mean, I come from Pakistan, right, which has something like 50, 60 million kids in the schooling system. So thinking about change there is not trivial.
Are there particular aspects of the report that make more of an impression when you're talking to these delegations?
In the GEEB report, we have this notion of great buys. And of course, we have this notion of bad buys. It's very nice to frame it that way, particularly bad buys. The role of research is not just saying what works. Sometimes it's better to say what does not work. Killing the bad ideas. Computers in classrooms. But it's just very little evidence that those things have an effect on student learning outcomes, unless they're embedded within some program, or unless they're embedded in the classroom dynamic, or unless you really understand how teachers use them, or whether teachers accept them, or so on. So this idea, which many people have, just flood the education system with computers. I think that's something where people need to take a second look. In the middle, we have this other category, which is very interesting, where I think a lot of the world is, which is interventions we think that are promising, but we don't have enough evidence. So it's not that, you know, evidence is really important, but it's also a constraint. There are lots of things that you and I, if we sit down more and discuss in detail, we can come up with some things we think, hey, we should, you know, they're worth trying, or they're even worth trying at scale. But we just don't have enough evidence to really back them up. And there we think that more work is needed. And I think technology, broadly speaking, is one of them. Technology is so dependent on how it is implemented. What do we even mean by technology? Technology in aid of support of teachers, technology in support of children, technology in terms of the soft idea about knowledge. And I think that we need to do a lot more work there trying to nail it down. Then we have grade buys. So the grade buys, I'm very vested in them. I mean, as a personal researcher, I've been involved in both of them. Information is one of them. We did a big report card intervention in Pakistan where we just gave information to both school systems and parents and teachers and everybody about how the kids were doing. And that created a very big dynamic among communities and villages. What we did is gave information at the local level. So that was really useful, how my kid was doing relative to other kids in the village and how our schools were doing. And that's one of the great buys. It's not very expensive to produce it. You have to be able to test kids, have that capability. But once there, it really does create this sense of both either accountability or competition, or just this sense of getting everybody involved. One of the more interesting people we met during the Education World Forum is this mayor of the Brazilian municipality of Sobral, who is now one of the leading proponents of reform. And he actually went out on radio. He made learning a political issue. Huh. So it's not just infrastructure, which is how many schools have boundary walls, how many teachers, student-teacher ratios. That's what I call inputs. But make learning, and just went out on the radio and started talking about the problems that he was seeing in terms of learnings and pointed out specific schools and so on. So I think that's one of the big buys. The second big buy, which is the great buy we have, which I think is really important, and particularly after COVID, I was very involved in that, is like structured pedagogy. And then, you know, what I would call targeted instruction, supporting teachers so they can teach kids at their level rather than at the pre-established curriculum. And I think that's, again, something that has been experimented in many different contexts. I've done a big one in Pakistan. I think there is emerging evidence enough that we can call it something worth pursuing.
Often in education policy, people are very invested in policies. Maybe there's not great evidence for them, and maybe they're not working. And in some of these good ideas, you're looking to overthrow their conventional wisdom. How open did you find them to talking about that? How entrepreneurial is it possible to be? As you say, some of the most promising interventions, at the moment, they lack strong evidence, or maybe we don't know how portable these policies are. How willing are these delegations to take risks?
The question is, do you want to think at risks at the level of pilots and risks at the level of experimentation, or the risk at the level of a country, right? I mean, to throw a country down a particular path is, for me to recommend somebody to do that, I mean, it's a pretty grave responsibility, right?
Yes.
So you don't want them to take risks in that sense of the word. If you go down this evidence route, what you do want them to do is to carefully evaluate what they are doing. I think that what you want to do is to get them into a process of intervening. That's what you call a policy, an intervention. Then you try to evaluate, set up a system of evaluation, and then set up a system of adaptation. I mean, it's not a one-time static thing. It's not a switch that you turn on and then you wait 10 years and you say the country has changed. So I think this process of getting feedback and getting these feedback loops in place where you can evaluate what you're doing and then you can adapt. I think a lot of models are really trying to go that way. At the same time, we have to realize that these ministers and policymakers, they operate in the real world. They have multiple constituents. I'll give you an example, right, of one thing which people believe in, but I think is really needs rethinking. It's an article of faith in education, teacher training. Everybody thinks teacher training is good. I think teacher training is good. But does it really work? What kind of training? Is it like teacher selection, teacher motivation, teacher knowledge, teacher pedagogy? Training is too large a word, but we have these training institutes. And in many these low and middle income countries, what I find is that these training institutes were set up at a particular point in time, and they are still in the same world. So I think that's something which is really interesting, where you want to really challenge them. And then teacher selection. What are you really looking for? How I select a teacher to teach high school physics is very different, like a preschool teacher. Mm-hmm. And do we want to have the same systems? The other is, which I find very interesting, is especially in large systems like Pakistan, India, Indonesia, Nigeria. I mean, these are big countries. How do you really grapple with heterogeneity?
Yeah.
In Pakistan, you have elite schools within the government where the students graduate and compete with the best students in the world. At the same time, we have students who are, by the time they hit fourth grade, they are 2 years behind in learning. Mm-hmm. And then the whole gamut in between. So policy, which we typically think of as like a uniform policy that applies to all. That's government. That's laws, right? That's what we think, right? They apply to all. But how do we create that sense? That's really the implementation part. That's a third part of the GEEP part, mm-hmm. right, is implementing. And I think that's where the local context really matters. We can provide evidence, circling back to your question about how do you get this message out. But I think how this message translates into their own local context, we can give them our processes, we can give them examples, we can tell them how to think about it. There's no one size fits all in that way, right?
Are there any examples that jump into your mind of ministers, of their teams, who are really doing a good job of approaching innovation in education?
We are engaged in a pretty serious endeavor. What I find is many earnest people. There are enough people that we can, within quotes, do business with. Within each ministry, what you will find is people who are champions of change. So it's not like Sierra Leone is better than Ethiopia or better than Pakistan or Chile or something like that. That's one way of thinking about it. But you find people within who are thinking about these things. And that's part of the idea of institutions. I was just in Morocco, not on GEEP business, but on research. And had a really nice conversation on thinking about some things that I thought were really promising. And a couple of things which I thought, at least theory tells us, probably not a good idea. They weren't too happy, but they accepted it. What I like is ministries, which is like glass half empty, half full. They have a lot to teach us, by the way. So I can't go in with the sense that I'm the expert, I know. So we have a lot to learn from them. And then their glass is quite full, so they can teach us. And then we have this dialogue. So I think that the most important thing is this dialogue part. But my sense is then I think about large countries and large missions. And I think that change does happen, but there's no magic bullet, right?
In the effort to locate a magic bullet or just to locate positive change, do you get the feeling that the ministries have the budgets that they need to realize their ambition?
That's a good point. It is really in response to questions like this that the whole idea of really emphasizing the cost effectiveness in GEEP came through, right? I think that's really important. So therefore, looking at like aggregate budgets as from Ministry of Finance, what is the resource allocation to education in general? It conceals as much as it reveals. What we are talking about is pushing reform. And I think that while budgets in many countries are woefully low, there is enough in there to also make an impact. I do point out that GEEP and we are really around the notion of primary learning, K through 5 is our big focus. We do go up all the way up to K through 10 and 12, but pre-K and that's what you're focusing on. We're not looking at like things like higher education and so on, which is a whole different conversation.
And we know now that COVID was a huge setback to education around the world. do you get the feeling that education in low middle income countries is recovering? Does your report help them to recover from the really bad things that happened both to individual children and to the system during COVID?
Yeah, I think that COVID was an unprecedented shock.
Yeah.
Pretty much every child in the world was out of school for a significant period of time. I focus on, and we focus on, kids from families that really cannot provide the support that is needed from out of school, be it in terms of technology or enrichment. The average levels of learning fell, that's for sure. It's documented now in many cases, not everywhere, because it's really difficult to do kind of a pre and post, but we have enough evidence on that. But what it also did is it created a lot more inequality within the system. And so therefore, really, it was a call to arms. In fact, we did take out a COVID report where, following the FDA type of stuff, where we actually went beyond in terms of all the evidence that we needed, because it was almost like an emergency situation when we could not rely on the regular procedures of what we had. So I think COVID was one of the GEEP power really came about coincidentally just at the time of COVID. So I think that was really important. At the same time, I'll tell you from my own experience, the positive part was that COVID was such a big shock. So there is this whole theory, right, of benefit of crisis for reform agendas, mm-hmm. that it created a real push. I think that at that point, everybody had to react. So complacency and what was chronic learning failures, which were happening in systems, all of them were jolted. So I found that to jumpstart, so I had conversations with the ministries in Pakistan in this, and it was pretty nice because nobody was on the defensive. You know, previously when you talked about systems and system failures and saying learning isn't happening, the people who were running those systems were always on the defensive saying we were attacking them. Well, in this case, there was a very nice third-party villain, which is called COVID. Mm-hmm. So even with teachers, what I found is tremendous openness in thinking about changing pedagogy. Otherwise, which would be a very difficult conversation because change behavior is one of the hardest things around. So I think COVID is both ways. I think that COVID has created a renewed sense of urgency in some places as much as it has created a crisis. Having said that, the evidence, which is medium run now coming in, right? We will find out how much recovery has taken place. And I think there's some evidence now in some study recently where there is a big dip and there is a recovery. But we need a lot more work on that because I think it will tell us a lot about this nature. But it did create a spur for innovation, both in terms of structured pedagogy, targeting instruction, thinking what kids were behind, all of that. I found a renewed openness to those discussions.
Where else do we need more work? As you say, there is a lot more research and a lot more evidence now than there used to be. Where are there still gaps in our knowledge?
I think that one gap in our knowledge is around implementation. Typically, in our best buys, we look at studies that have been done in more real-world contexts where the real field stuff is present. They're not fully controlled, but they are still studies. So the one big challenge is how to think about scaling up this reform. I think that's something that a lot of people are thinking about. And then taking implementation and kind of a take-up seriously. You know, the technical term is like take-up of an innovation. You try out an innovation, it doesn't work, but really the reality is not too many people bought into the system. So I think that we have to bring in more interdisciplinary methods, maybe others, to think about what's going on within school. How do we get teachers to change their behavior? If we want them to change, if we want them to adapt to technology, how do we really bring parents in? I mean, in my situation, moms are very important, but moms in the previous generation were largely illiterate. How do you really catalyze a child's learning ecosystem as things are changing? That's all I'm thinking about it. So one is implementation, and the other is really thinking about the child's broader ecosystem and thinking about particularly children at the lower end of the income scale.
To hear that there are huge opportunities, as you say, but there are also an enormous set of challenges. At the end of an event like the Education World Forum, do you feel optimistic or pessimistic about the future for education?
It's not whether you're optimistic or pessimistic. The question is, what's your best response? The best response is to continue working. Always thinking about where else can we go, where else can we move. We just got to keep the momentum going. That's how research takes place. We're always pushing the knowledge frontier. And now when we are integrating implementation and policy and political economy, I find it an exciting time. Now you can't have a conversation without using the word AI. think about personalized learning. How do we personalize the issues of each particular child, especially the kids who are the least able to help themselves or families? That's an opportunity.
The work is never over, so Tahir, good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Tim.
The report is called Cost-Effective Approaches to Improve Global Learning, and that was published in 2023 by Geep. If you want to listen to the episode where I spoke to Rachel Glenister, that came out in July 2023, that was called Cost-Effective Ways to Improve Global Learning. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe, you'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Please remember to share episodes that you enjoy, rate and review us as well, and then more people can find out about Vox Dev Talks.